Way, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. A team of scientists at the Pennsylvania State University recently discovered that an incredibly rare astrophysical event called a fast radio burst may have also been accompanied by a high-powered pulse of gamma rays. In the first half of the program, we talk with one of the astronomers to learn about fast radio bursts as well as the significant output of gamma rays they discovered. In part two, we talk with the author of a new book that outlines the history of mankind's most important engineering accomplishments. First, take a listen to this. I know it was quick, so listen again. That's the sound of a fast radio burst, or FRB. A fast radio burst is a powerful pulse of radio waves that lasts only a few milliseconds and are said to originate millions or even billions of light years from Earth. FRBs are so rare and elusive that so far only 18 have been detected since they were first discovered in 2007 with a radio telescope at Australia's Parkes Observatory. New research conducted by astronomers at the Pennsylvania State University, or Penn State, in State College, Pennsylvania, suggests that these fast radio bursts may also be capable of unleashing a billion times more gamma ray energy than radio waves. The amount of gamma ray power may even match that released by supernovae or exploding massive stars. Today, we talk with Derek Fox, an associate professor of astronomy and astrophysics at Penn State and a member of the research team that made the discovery. Professor Fox, can you describe just what is a fast radio burst?
Well, a fast radio burst is just like a really quick pulse of radio wavelength radiation coming from some distant source out in the cosmos. They just last about a millisecond long. But because they happen very far away, the signal drifts across the frequencies of a radio receiver, stretching it out to about a second long. And so that decreasing frequency makes a sort of whistle-type noise. It sort of goes like, pew, across the radio receiver band. That is very distinctive and serves to separate these fast radio bursts from all the other radio phenomena that we are aware of.
Why is it so mysterious?
The fast radio burst comes down to two important properties. One, that drift in that slow drift in frequency that we hear from the fast radio burst indicates that they're actually very far away, let's say hundreds of millions to billions of light years. And that means there are really substantial energies involved. And then second, they seem to be happening quite frequently, actually, on the sky, as much as 2,000 times a day.
Looking at the fast radio burst, you've mentioned that the fast radio burst sort of spans the breadth of radio wavelength. What causes this to change, to whistle?
When you send a sharp pulse of radio frequency radiation through the interstellar medium or the intergalactic medium, you're going to pass by a whole lot of free electrons, and those electrons slow down the lower frequencies by comparison to the higher frequencies. So it's a plasma propagation effect.
Any idea of what causes them?
Theorists have published a number of models. I don't think I want to get into ranking them here, but I'll just say that without counterparts or host galaxies or even really good distances for these fast radio bursts, we've sort of been in the dark as to what is actually making them.
Okay, so what kind of events would trigger one of these fast radio bursts?
A couple of popular models that have been proposed. We might have a magnetar, which is a highly magnetized, dense, collapsed remnant of a massive star that puts out a spike of radio transmissions. And those would have to be relatively nearby the Milky Way galaxy, so not at the upper end of the distance range, but relatively nearby. You can sort of do something like this with a less magnetized neutron star, something more like an ordinary radio pulsar. We have lots of repeating radio pulsars in our galaxy, and if it's a young pulsar, it may occasionally make a particularly bright pulse that looks a little bit, that is reminiscent in some ways of a fast radio burst. And then other scenarios, as we go further away from the Milky Way, we sort of require greater and greater energies. And so theorists have proposed that if they're really that far away, maybe what we have to do is collide two neutron stars together to get the energy out, or have some catastrophic event involving a magnetar or a black hole or something like that.
An earlier study I happened to come across is that some scientists think that FRBs come from highly magnetized gas-filled regions of space. What would that have to do with producing fast radio bursts?
I think what the scenario is there is we take a magnetar and we put it in the middle of a big bubble, maybe the bubble that was created when the massive star that exploded to make the magnetar, when it exploded, it blew off a lot of gas. So if I put a magnetar in a bubble of plasma like that, and then the magnetar makes a fast radio burst, that might help explain some of their properties.
The new study that you were involved with that was recently released found that along with the radio waves from the FRB, you found high-powered gamma rays. What are gamma rays and how do they differ from radio waves?
Gamma rays, that's the term we use to refer to the highest energy photons, the highest energy type of light that we observe or study as astronomers. The energies of an individual photon are, let's say, 100,000 or a million times the energy of the typical photon that we see with our naked eye. It doesn't take a lot of gamma rays to make a very energetic signal, and that's sort of what we see here, is a pulse of gamma rays that, energetically speaking, boosts the energy requirements for this fast radio burst by more than a billion times.
I understand you had mentioned a little earlier about the sound of an FRB, a sort of whistling sound. Gamma ray emissions also have a distinctive sound. What kind of sound does gamma rays make?
I'm not sure, but I usually think of it as a big bang, because it's a huge release of energy. Like I said, more than a billion times the radio frequency emissions from this source. So something like a star exploding or a black hole being formed.
So the gamma ray emission itself, does it last shorter or longer than the radio burst?
In this case, we see gamma ray emission lasting from 2 to 6 minutes after the fast radio burst, very short fast radio burst pulse.
Is it a possibility one bred the other? In other words, gamma ray emission produced radio burst or vice versa?
It's our assertion, by when we say the gamma ray counterpart, we mean that the gamma rays and the fast radio bursts are coming from the same source, but the details of how that happens remain to be worked out. We are not able to zero in on a clear winner in terms of models for this event yet.
Tell us about the FRB your team studied. How did you find it, first of all, and what kind of information was used to provide the data to make your findings?
The fast radio bursts are discovered by radio astronomers using the largest radio telescopes that we have. Initially discovered, and many of the examples that we work with today were discovered by the Parkes Observatory radio telescope in Parkes, Australia, which is a 64-meter dish, so one of the largest radio telescopes in the world.
I understand that's where the first FRB was detected?
Yep, so they sort of inaugurated the whole field with a paper they published in 2010 about a fast radio burst, the first fast radio burst they discovered, which was in data from 2007.
Do you suspect any other counterparts to FRBs?
Yes, as a consequence of the large energy release we infer for this fast radio burst, we suspect there could easily have been a long-lived X-ray radio or optical emission, or maybe an associated supernova. We try to set some limits. We looked in the data that we had without finding any of these, and we try to set some limits. But really what we need are more opportunities to go and look and see if we find these long-lived counterparts.
You had mentioned the Parkes radio telescope in Australia. Did you use any other facilities to develop your findings?
So the fast radio burst we study happened in November of 2013, so about 3 years ago, mm-hmm. and it was discovered by a team of radio observers using the Parkes telescope. They triggered some follow-up observations, and they wrote a paper about the radio wavelength emissions without knowing that there was this gamma ray component to the emissions from the burst. So when we wrote our paper, we also took advantage of those observations. We used not just the radio data from Parkes, but also X-ray and optical data from NASA's SWIFT mission, and also imaging and spectroscopic data from the European Very Large Telescope in Chile.
On a related note, astronomers have announced that they have found the 18th FRB since 2007, when it was first discovered. Among their findings, they say that this FRB might be able to provide some insight into something called a cosmic web. Now, what is a cosmic web? Is this the material you were talking about, intergalactic material?
Yes, the cosmic web is how we refer to gas, so ordinary hydrogen and helium gas that lives between galaxies, so the intergalactic medium. And the reason they call it the web is because when we simulate the universe in computers, we see that the gas has a tendency to collapse into these thin sort of ribbons of material stretching between galaxies. So I think it's rather picturesque, but it's also quite accurate.
Have these elements been seen at all, or just is it theoretical?
You see signs of the cosmic web with ultraviolet spectroscopy, and there have also been some imaging observations, but it's early days for this aspect of the field. And so our clearest pictures really come from the simulations, where, of course, you can see where everything is and you have perfect knowledge.
Any idea of where this material came from?
It's a very interesting question. Some of it will have been primordial, so just born with the universe.
Mm-hmm.
But from what we see from observations, almost all of it has signs of having been passed through previous generations of stars. So when galaxies make stars and the stars explode as supernovae, they blast gas out back out into the intergalactic medium. And so you get these heavier elements out there just in the dark spaces between galaxies as well.
Maybe ask you to speculate a little bit. I'm kind of curious, how would scientists be able to gather insight and learn more about the cosmic web through a fast radio burst?
Well, the signal's propagating toward us from hundreds of millions or billions of light years away. And along the way, we already talked about how the lower frequencies are delayed as they pass by all of those many free electrons. So that's already a measurement of the quantity of plasma in intergalactic space. And with bright bursts like the one reported, it's possible as well to make a measurement of the average magnetic field along that very long path to wherever the fast radio burst originated. And so these are questions that astronomers are certainly very interested in. You know, how dense is the gas in the intergalactic medium? How much of it is out there? How ionized is it? And how magnetized is it?
I'm sure our listeners may wonder, when they hear about a powerful burst of energy coming from outer space, of course some people worry. Are these fast radio bursts dangerous at all?
I don't think so. I think really you're talking about emissions that would be dwarfed by your average nearby airport radar system, cellular phone towers. So there's a lot of radio emissions going on naturally. Solar flares put out radio wavelength as well. So I don't think these are really the top concern, or should be the top concern for
listeners. Back to your study, are you and your team doing any follow-up work to the one that you just completed? If so, what do you hope to find?
I think we tried to sort of wrap up all the work that we could in our one paper on that burst from 2013. And what we're doing now is we're going and talking to our friends, the radio observers, and trying to work out how we can really increase the rate of discovery for the fast radio burst and also the number of fast radio bursts that get this sort of devoted follow-up campaign.
Professor Fox, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk about fast radio bursts. It's a mystery, but you've managed to somehow demystify it, and we appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm glad to be helpful. Thanks a lot, Rick.
That was Derek Fox, an associate professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the Pennsylvania State University in State College, Pennsylvania. You're listening to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA, or send us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. We'll be back with more of our program after this.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians.
And
sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience, at voanews.com.
We're back with the science edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. My guest in our second segment today is Tom Jackson. He has written a number of science books, including his latest, Engineering, an Illustrated History of Ancient Craft to Modern Technology. Tom's book lists and details some of the greatest engineering achievements of all time. It's written in a way that's very easy to understand, and it's packed full of pictures and illustrations. Tom, what is engineering, and what does an engineer actually do?
Well, the engineering is the application of scientific knowledge to solve a problem, to make something useful, or to improve on what there is before. What an engineer does is a good question, in that a lot of people might think an engineer is a guy wearing overalls in a workshop with some tools and covered in grease. When really an engineer works in all kinds of fields. There are genetic engineers, computer software engineers, as well as the engineers that do the big stuff like the bridges and the tunnels and build the passenger jets and the ships. It's someone who takes scientific knowledge and uses it, draws all the different strands together to solve a problem.
Tom, why did you do this book?
Well, it's the seventh book in what we call the Ponderable series. Each book has the same concept, which is to take a subject and cut it up into 100 steps that run chronologically. So we start at the beginning of the story and end at the end, which is generally the best way of doing it. So we've done books on chemistry, astronomy, physics, philosophy, mathematics, and the last one was the brain, which was a slight departure. And so each of the 100 articles in the book tell you an important factoid or development, discovery, and invention that relates to that subject. Because they're all in order, because there's 100 of them, you can see where each step came from, what came before, and how it arose out of earlier knowledge. So you see the sort of the progression of the subject.
In doing the research for this book, and I'm sure a lot of research went into it, did you find anything that really surprised you?
Yeah. I found out that the first communication satellite was a metal balloon.
Echo 1.
That's right, yeah, which I thought was quite fun. Normally, they skip straight through to Telstar, which is the satellite that first carried commercial civilian TV signals and radio signals across the Atlantic. But there was an experimental version launched by NASA a couple of years before, which was just a giant, not quite tin foil, but a metal balloon. It was a bit thicker than a foil balloon. That was just like a mirror in orbit, and it was up there, and they would bounce radio signals off it just to see where it came from. Everything's a surprise. Another one of my favorite stories is about Charles Parsons, who invented the turbine engine. So, I mean, jet engines are a form of this engine, but they originally came from much larger ocean-going vessels, creating thrust in a different way. So he invented it, and no one in the establishment wanted to know anything about it. And there's a tradition where the Royal Navy would line up all its largest ships, and the King would come and... And he gate-crashed that event, turning up in this high-speed boat that he'd built, with it was powered by his turbine, which he called Turbinia, and zoomed around in front of the King and all the admirals. And the admirals got annoyed about this and sent their boats to go and catch him. And, of course, none of them could. He was just zooming around,
right,
being chased by all of the finest ships that the Royal Navy had to offer. And then, of course, people realized that he was onto something. And then within 10 years, the first almost invincible battleships were all being powered by this kind of engine. And it's that sort of class of cruise ship and ocean liner, the fastest ships on the sea were being powered by these things.
Since you do go in somewhat chronological order in your book, I noticed that engineering seems to predate the human race. You write of ancestors of modern humans making and using stone tools. So could you give us some examples of this most early technology? How did this change as humans evolved?
I don't know if the listeners are aware, but there are six simple machines. So any machine you can think of, from a car to a turbine that we were talking about, is really a collection of six simple machines that are all connected together to work together. They're transforming forces. They're enlarging, boosting forces, or they're changing the direction of these forces. There are things like the ramp, the wheel and axle, a pulley, these sorts of things. One of them is a wedge, which might be easier to understand as an axe. If you look at an axe head, it's a wedge-shaped thing, and it's the way what it's doing is that a force is applied to the wide edge, And then at the thin end of the wedge is where it comes from. Well, that force is concentrated, and therefore you get a cutting effect. No one's exactly sure, but there's certainly evidence. They think that first bipedal hominid that's been found in Africa, yeah, they think she and her kind were using stone tools cut into wedges. You know, like a very primitive version of a flint arrowhead or something like that. But, you know, the same idea, cutting into these wedge-shaped sharp edges, which can be used as a cutting tool. Now we just assume that once we've invented something's going to come along and invent something that improves it or replaces it or does the same thing but better. That didn't happen. So the same style of stone cutter was being used for hundreds of thousands of years. And it would appear that the culture of making these tools didn't develop any faster than the biology of the early human ancestors that made them. So they didn't have this innovative, scheming mind that the modern humans have. And then, of course, you know, 40,000 years ago, there's the great sort of burgeoning of innovation that's sort of seen with the arrival of all the cave paintings and all sorts of stone technology. Still stone, and that's what's left behind. Obviously, they were using wood and bone and stuff, but we don't find as much of that. And then by 40,000 years, there's this huge sort of explosion of this stuff. So there's obviously something that's happened that means that culture then moves faster, then innovates faster than the biology. This book is really about everything from that point onwards. Consequently, it's quite a lot of stuff to try and get in.
Tom, can we get an idea from you on what you would consider to be some of the most important technological accomplishments throughout history?
Writing. But writing didn't actually make it into the book, but it's kind of important. Pottery, for two reasons. It was really the first sort of synthetic substance. So you take raw ingredients and put it through a process. So that was the first use of raw material, transforming it into something more useful and permanent. But of course, pottery technology leads to the pottery wheel. The first wheels are thought to be used for making pots rather than for chariots, but I can't imagine it didn't take that much time before they started to put it onto wagons and things like that. I always think refrigeration is a much overlooked bit of technology. Fire has been at the command of humans, and they used it in pottery, the pottery technology. Whereas the ability to control cold took, you know, another million years to figure out. Mm-hmm. We only really got to grips with it fully in that we understood what was going on and we understood how to make machines to do it safely.
The one thing that really caught my eye at first was Thomas Savery and the Miner's Friend.
Oh, yeah, the steam engine, yes. It's often the way that the names aren't anything like what we now call the steam engine. The first one was called the Miner's Friend or an engine to raise water by fire. So it didn't really work that much like what we might understand a steam engine to do now, but it was effectively using the forces produced when you heat up water into steam, applies a pressure, and then you can condense it. That's a reciprocating force. And that was 1698, as the name suggests. It was used to pump water out of mines. But within 15 years, a guy called Thomas Newcomen kind of improved on it. Design-wise, he didn't change the principle. He just built a machine that harnessed those principles better to make the giant pumps and other engines used for. They were too large. They were building-sized things, these giant steam engines, for use in mines and similar sorts of settings. And then 50 years after that, you get steam engines which begin to be small enough and reliable enough to use for locomotion, and then boom, off we go. Then we're on high speed, long distance travel, you know, with trains and railroads.
Among some of the more modern technological innovations that we look at that are pretty important would be the internet and the World Wide Web. And I understand from reading your book that there is a difference between the two. I always thought the internet and World Wide Web were the same thing.
No, completely different. Well, I mean, it's frequently said that the internet is the sort of the physical thing. So it's all the computer networks that are networked together. So a network of networks, or the network that connects all the networks. But it's also a little bit more than that. There's a, you know, IP, internet protocol. Everyone has constantly being asked to type in their IP address, or an error message comes up, your IP address is wrong, or whatever. You know, everyone will have come across IP, internet protocol, which is one of the means by which information is sent through this network of networks, through this internet. So the internet was set up as a defense program, really, in that after the Second World War, communications were obviously becoming much more important for the military,
And they realized that there was just one telephone line connecting, I don't know, one military base with another military base. And if you cut that line, then they couldn't talk to each other as effectively as they had planned to. And so the vulnerabilities of the communication network were addressed by building a system where the messages found their own way through a network. So they didn't have to go, like a telephone call, didn't have to go from where the message started directly along the line to where the message was being sent to. It could travel off in any direction it wanted, and eventually it would find its way there. And it would also be chopped up into small little packets, and each packet would know its place amongst all the other packets, and they'd all arrive at the far end, and if there were any missing, the far end, the receiver would send back a message through the internet saying, I'd still need packet 7, 12, and 32, and those packets would be sent off and they'd find their way. If they failed because the connection was cut halfway along or whatever, they would just be sent again along another route. So that's the internet, effectively. Okay. And then there's a, you know, that's the technology behind it. And then it was rolled out through the academic computer network, and then the civilian telephone network joined in. You've got this interconnected network that computers can talk to each other with, but it's still very much a push technology in that you've got your computer, it's connected to the internet, and you just communicate with other computers, but you've got to push it at that computer. You've got to say, right, this, I've got to send a message from to Bob, and you send a message to Bob. And emails and things like that are working by this stage, and there are file transfer protocols, and the FTP, that sort of thing is all set up and running. Then a guy who actually, Tim Berners-Lee, he invented the World Wide Web. So he's a British guy. He was working in Switzerland at the time. He invented a system where you could pull whatever information you wanted from one of these connected computers. So it would have the information, the data, whatever it would be, pictures, text, would be stored on this computer. And instead of having to ask for that computer to send you that information so it would all travel to your computer and then you could load it onto your computer and look at it, you could just view the information on that computer through effectively some sort of virtual screen, like the web browser, and just pull bits that you needed on request. Tim Berners-Lee gave it to humanity, effectively, or he didn't start charging people for the technology. I think some of it belongs to CERN, which is, you know, the Large Hadron Collider in CERN. Right. He was a computer scientist working there, and he had this idea of a way of disseminating information much more effectively, and it's grown into the web that we use to communicate with.
Tom, among all the technological engineering innovations you outline in your book, you conclude your book with a profile of some really notable engineers and inventors. What two engineer/inventors do you think had the biggest impact on humanity?
Tesla, Nikola Tesla. Crazy name, crazy guy. He was a Serbian, although he was born in what's now Croatia, and was just a genius in electrical engineering. The way that electricity comes from your nearest power plant, or even the most distant power plant, through the electricity grid, that he invented that, effectively. So that has quite a big effect. All the idea of transformers stepping up voltage and stepping it down, so the high voltage is good for sending large amounts of electricity over long distances. But of course, if you plug your new MacBook into high voltage, then it's just going to explode. Mm-hmm. But you have to step it back down again once it gets to into the domestic supply. So that technology effectively is Tesla's technology. And he gave it to George Westinghouse, effectively, who then used it to wipe Thomas Edison's ambitions of being, the king of the world electricity supply.
Tom, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk about your book, and I really appreciate it and wish you good luck on your book.
Well, thank you very much. It's been great fun talking to you.
That was science author Tom Jackson. His recently released book is Engineering, an Illustrated History of Ancient Craft to Modern Technology, and is available through your favorite online bookseller. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank both of our guests for joining us for today's program. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castile next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.